Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Karen Halpert.
And I want to introduce my guest co-host, Dr. Karen Halpert, who is one of our fabulous resident physicians at UNC Family Medicine. And she's kind enough to fill in for Adam today while he is away. Thanks for being with us, Karen.
My pleasure.
On our show today, Karen and I will be talking with Dr. John Wyatt, Professor Emeritus of Neonatal Pediatrics at University College London, about the journey of medical ethics and faith. And that is such an important topic, and we're looking forward to that conversation.
But first, Christy, we need to get to research that matters.
Yeah, we're going to talk about thinking related to obsessive compulsive disorder.
Prescriptions that get unfilled.
About your health and being young and fit.
And peeing in the pool. Ick.
Gross. All right, we'll end with that one. But let's start with a study about obsessive compulsive thinking. This was published in the Journal of Obsessive Compulsive and Related Disorders, appropriately, and gives us some information from 777 university students in 13 countries across six continents.
You're right, Christy. And this study showed that 94% of people experience unwanted intrusive thoughts, images, and or impulses. You know, basically those thoughts of, did I wash my hands? Did I lock the door? Or is my house on fire? And Adam Radomski, who is the Concordia psychology professor who published this story, thought that, you know, the findings show that majority of the people have these types of thoughts, but it's really what you do with them that can give you a diagnosis of OCD. And they hope that, you know, by normalizing this behavior, we can hopefully reduce the stigma about people with obsessive compulsive disease, but also make inroads in the behavioral interventions and therapy we do with that population.
Yeah. So the take home point, if you're having thoughts or you have frequent thoughts about checking the door, the car, the kitchen, talk with your doctors. There are therapies that can help, and it can be important to distinguish out whether these are just thoughts or whether or not it's really impeding your life, because there is help for that kind of problem. But let's talk about prescriptions, Karen.
Prescriptions. So a new Canadian study showed that one in three prescriptions go unfilled.
And that's kind of interesting. I think we've talked about that before, that people don't always fill the prescriptions that doctors prescribe. But what does this tell us?
So this tells us that people who have high prescription drug copays or got prescriptions for really expensive drugs were more likely to not fill those drugs. And basically, if you are having difficulty with finances, you really need to talk with your doctor, you know, while they're writing that prescription to make sure that you get treated and get the right prescription that you can afford.
It's important to know what that treatment is for and why is that important in your life. From the study, it sounds like antibiotic prescriptions were often filled, but the medicines for heart disease or for headache or for more ongoing problems like depression were the ones that were less likely to be filled, especially if they were brand name drugs and not the generics. So if that's a problem, or if you get a prescription from a doctor and you think, I'm not even going to fill this, you might as well have that conversation before you leave.
Exactly. So this next study looks at age and physical fitness and how you will mental function will be later on in life. And in the journal Neurology, David Jacobs of the University of Minnesota, who designed and led the study, showed that people in their 20s who were in shape were more likely to be sharp thinkers 25 years later.
I know. So they did a treadmill test at the beginning and followed them 25 years later. The longer you could go on this treadmill test in your 20s, the better you did in thinking skills. Obviously, I didn't do very well on the treadmill test. I can't get my words out. The better you did in your thinking skills 25 years later, implying that being young and fit and then continuing in that fitness helps keep you sharp.
Exactly. And this effect even goes that if you kept up your fitness, you did better.
So let's talk about peeing in the pool.
Yes. So this is a big topic as the sunshine comes out and the bikinis come out as well, that people are going to be hopping in that beautiful pool. Well, we always hear about celebrities who always comment that, you know, we urinate in the pool. But is that safe?
Well, I'm not as worried about the celebrities as I am the children in the pool. But that tells you my stage of life.
That's true. In the Environmental Science and Technology Journal, a publication of the American Chemical Society, they looked at urine and chlorine and if the combination of these chemicals combined form potentially dangerous substances.
A couple of different chemicals. One that's found in urine, and the chlorine that is the main thing found in pools.
Yes. And the two chemicals they were looking to see if they were created were trichloramine and cyanogen chloride. And these two chemicals have kind of long-term effects on the lungs and nervous system. And when they combine these two chemicals in the lab, when they combine the uric acid and chlorine in the lab, they did find that these two chemicals were made. And they hypothesized that if you look at the compounds in swimming pools, most of that comes from urine. But I wouldn't go running out of the pool too fast. These chemicals are kind of found in nature, but we do want to limit the long-term exposure to our children and to ourselves.
Yeah, I think this, I mean, it doesn't link it to really bad things that happen to people because of being exposed to urine in the pool. But I would agree that we just really shouldn't pee in the pool, for one, and continue to try to do our very best with our children to limit that as much as possible.
I agree. Get out of the pool. Don't use it as your bathroom.
That's true. All right. Well, we've had a chance to talk a little bit about peeing in the pool and about being young and fit and old and sharp and about prescription refills and prescriptions going unfilled, as well as a bit about obsessive compulsive thinking. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. John Wyatt, Professor Emeritus of Neonatal Pediatrics at University College London, about the journey of medical ethics and faith.
You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Karen Helpert.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Karen Helpert, our guest co-host today, who's filling in while Adam is away. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. John Wyatt, Professor Emeritus of Neonatal Pediatrics at University College London, about the journey of medical ethics and faith. Dr. Wyatt, you're traveling through the States giving lots of presentations, and we're really grateful that you've taken the time to be with us and talk with us about your work.
Thank you very much. It's really good to be here.
Dr. Wyatt, I'm a third-year resident, so I'm just beginning my journey along this path. You're a neonatologist with a strong belief that medical ethics and faith are linked. Can you tell us more about your journey and how this became your life's work?
Yes, I trained in London in medicine and was for quite a lot of time not clear which specialty to go into. But eventually, I decided that pediatrics was the route to go after, to having some experience of internal and adult medicine, and then quite rapidly found myself, much to my surprise, of working in an intensive care unit for babies with some incredibly tiny, sick, and vulnerable little babies. And something really just excited me about this kind of work. And so I I got involved in the work not at all because of the ethical challenges, but just because of the fascination with the advances in this area and what it was possible to do for the youngest and the sickest babies.
Well, you are working on a book now, but you published a book in the past with a couple revisions called Matters of Life and Death, Human Dilemmas in the Light of Christian Faith. And I wonder if you might speak to what led you to write that book and sort of how that applies to people of the Christian faith and to other belief systems.
So as I was working in this area, I realized that I was in the midst of an ethical whirlwind of new challenges and dilemmas which were arising to do with, as technology advanced, it led to more and more challenges and difficult questions. Was it ever right to switch off the machinery and let a baby die? Should we try and resuscitate every baby, even if there was brain damage or other problems? And what about the whole terrible question about abortion versus, you know, these terrible, difficult dilemmas where in our country it's possible to have a late abortion sometimes at the same gestational ages at which babies are being saved by intensive care. And so finding myself confronted with some of these terrible, challenging and difficult issues, I just felt that I needed to try and think my way through how I would respond to that as a human being, first of all, but also as a Christian believer, as somebody who believed that the Christian faith and that Jesus Christ was an example for the way to live. And so how on earth you relate the ancient Christian faith 2,000 years ago to these really modern, difficult, challenging technical questions? I mean, that's really what I've been wrestling with for the rest of my life.
And as you put those things together of what we can do and what we should do, whether that be in ethical agreements of people from different faith backgrounds, and it's certainly different, you know, depending on your faith background. But how do you how have you begun to think through some of the most common issues? And maybe you should start there with what are the most common issues, or an example of a story where you really had to wrestle with, we can do this, but should we do this?
Well, I think one of the obvious areas is to do with babies who are born right at the very limits of viability. So normally their pregnancy is for 9 months, but sometimes a woman will go into labor at as many as 5 months, a shorter time, and a tiny little baby is born alive who may be 22, 23 weeks of gestation, who is clearly alive, struggling, pink, breathing, trying to cry. And yet we know that if we were to try to keep this baby alive with intensive care, it might cost weeks or months in the intensive care unit, and it might have a very high risk of causing kinds of problems, brain damage, and others. And I can think of cases where I've been in the hot spot. I've been the doctor there at the delivery, tried to have a conversation before birth. Sometimes it all happens in such a fast time that there isn't even possible to have that conversation. And then trying to do what is right in that situation, trying to be wise. Sometimes I think the right thing is to say, I'm very, very sorry, but there really is nothing we can do. And the right thing to do is to do nothing but to keep the baby warm and do nothing else.
And just as a quick follow-up question to that, we were talking just last week with Dr. Benjamin Wilfond about accepting brain death and some of this of accepting when a baby or a loved one is gone. How do you, understanding the complexities of this on a medical end, of what you know as a physician, of what things that can be done, the risks, and parents who are devastated, and who haven't been to medical school and seen all the different ways it can turn out, how do you present those issues in a way that doesn't leave them feeling like they had to make a choice of doing everything for their child or not?
It's a really difficult issue, and I don't have any easy answer. But one approach which I've tried to develop and to encourage other doctors to think about is what I call an expert-expert relationship, that that in the old-fashioned approach to medicine was what's often called paternalism, where, you know, doctor knows best, just mm-hmm. trust me, I'm a physician, I'll do the best thing, you don't need to worry your little head about this. Mm-hmm. And I think we all understand that that just doesn't work in the modern world, that isn't appropriate. But nor can we just hand over to the parents and say, well, whatever you want, whatever, if you want us to do intensive care, we'll do intensive care. If you don't want us to do intensive care, we won't. That doesn't work either.
No.
So I think the best approach is to recognize that we're both experts. I, as the physician, am supposed to be the expert in what the treatment options are in terms of what the possible risks would be, but also, I hope, an expert in terms of humanity and wisdom and life in other ways, more than purely technical. But parents are experts too. They're experts in terms of their own background, in terms of their own history, in terms of their own philosophy and their beliefs. And so the best way forward, it seems to me, is to try to meet together with respect, with a sense of trying to work together in partnership to try to discover the best way forward.
One question I have is, you know, when you have these discussions and you have a sick baby, you have a family that's been really excited about a pregnancy, who do you encourage the family to bring around when they're making these tough decisions and they're reflecting on their faiths and their belief system?
Well, it's a good question, and I think the truth is it's very variable. But I think trying to get to know people and their background is a very important part. So certainly, if it's a couple, I would always encourage I would try to speak to the couple together. I think it's a very bad idea to speak to one member of a partnership, of two partners, without the other being there. Sometimes if it's a single mother, then the best person would be the grandmother. And I've had a lot of conversations with perhaps young, single, unsupported women to try and encourage an older member of the family, particularly grandmother, to be there and engage in this discussion and this dialogue. Sometimes there are close friends. Sometimes there are members from faith communities who would be particularly helpful, a pastor, a rabbi, an imam. So over the years, I've had very many different kinds of conversations with different groups of people. But I think the whole basis is trying to have a genuine listening of mutual respect.
We are talking with Dr. John Wyatt, a neonatologist from University College in London, about the journey of medical ethics and faith. And we do need to take a short break, Dr. Wyatt, but we're looking forward to extending this conversation when we return. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Karen Halpert. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and our guest co-host today, Dr. Karen Halpert, who is filling in for Adam. We've been talking with Dr. John Wyatt, Professor Emeritus of Neonatal Pediatrics at University College London, about the journey of medical ethics and faith. And Dr. Wyatt, I have all kinds of questions for you, but I wanted to get into this issue of control and humility on the perspective of the medical team. I think a lot of times as technology has advanced, and you wrote about this in your book, as technology has advanced, we like to think that we know what's going to happen or what we're able to do. And I think patients probably think that we're able to do more than maybe we can. We may anticipate someone will live and they don't. We might anticipate someone will die and they don't. And miracles happen, and we've seen them. And in the context of I certainly believe in miracles, but whether you do or not, how does one navigate that element of control versus humility?
Well, it's a very good question. I think that modern people, it's a particular modern disease, is this belief that we can control every aspect of our lives. And particularly young mobile professionals, we have a lot of them in London, and they, it's to do with child rearing. They've blocked out a particular block. They say, I'm going to stop work there. I'm going to get pregnant here. I'm going to have my baby here. I'm going to have 2 months off work, and then I'm going straight back to work. And the whole thing is planned. And then, bang, a baby is born at the wrong time. It's got all kinds of medical problems. And all that planning is suddenly just destroyed at a moment. And I sometimes think that maybe God, in his wisdom and his sovereign purposes, sometimes uses biology to remind us that we are not God, that we are not the ones in total control. And yes, there are very mysterious things. And I can think of examples in my own case. I can think of an example where I was with a baby who had had very severe damage, and this baby was dying, and there was nothing that could be done. And I was with the father, and the father was holding this little baby, and this baby just gasped the last gasp. And it was a terribly tragic and poignant little moment. And I waited and I waited, and I said, I think she's just slipped away. And the baby took a huge gasp, and the doctor and the father said, oh, look, doctor, she's gone all pink. And I said, yes, she has, hasn't she? And actually that baby survived and carried on and lived for over a year and a half. And she did have significant problems, and yet that little life was significant and precious. And, you know, one of the things I think that, again, a Christian perspective has taught me is that sometimes it's not necessarily the perfect specimens of humanity that are the most important and the most significant. Sometimes those who struggle, those who are weak, those who are vulnerable and fragile, sometimes those little lives can be just as significant as the perfect specimens.
Going along with that, you know, when you have these vulnerable patients and you see miracles often, but more of the time you do seem to find that people have poor prognosis and they, you know, families have hope for something more. How do you talk to a family or kind of make that decision that maybe it is time to withdraw care?
Well, I think the real thing is we have to balance, as physicians, we always have to balance the benefits that our treatment is giving against the burdens, that the challenges. And it is possible, I'm afraid, for invasive medical care even to become like a form of child abuse. We're actually damaging and torturing our patients. So we don't mean to, but sometimes this is what happens. And so part of, I think, my role as a physician is to say enough is enough. It's time to stop. Sometimes to allow death to occur. And again, there's a very interesting thing here from a faith perspective, that what in Christianity, there's a sort of ambivalence about death. On the one hand, death is a terrible enemy and is described in the Bible as the last enemy, the enemy that we fight against. And so part of medical practice is to fight against death, hold it off. But also there's a strange sense in which in Christian thinking death can also be a strange kind of mercy, even a kind of healing, a gateway into the future. And I was talking to one of my colleagues who is not a believer, who's an atheist, a fellow neonatologist, and he said, you know, John, when you're caring for a sick baby who's dying, you're sending them to heaven. When I'm caring for a sick baby, I'm sending them to the rubbish heap. And it was meant as a joke, but actually we both knew there was something real about that, that our fundamental beliefs actually alter the way in which we care for our patients.
Wow, and that also weighs into some of the challenges of having different perspectives with your colleagues when you're sharing care and sharing responsibility for patients and being able to have those open discussions about your differences perhaps in faith.
Well, that's very much a challenge of modern society and modern medical care is that yes, the technical term is we're a pluralistic society. We have many different faiths and beliefs, and yet we are trying to work together as teams. And I think the best way to do that is not to put all these issues under the carpet as though they didn't exist, which sometimes is what tends to be implied in modern medicine. We just do the technical stuff and we don't bother to think about these things. I think it's actually healthier to actually be honest and open about our different beliefs and then say, but can we agree together? What's the best way to handle this situation?
And how do your colleagues, or have they responded to your work, really putting out your faith, both in those discussions and in your book, with your work?
Well, I get different reactions, and sometimes I get some good-natured teasing, you know, and I don't know what's wrong with this baby. We better ask John. He's got the hotline, you know, that kind of teasing, which, of course, you know, I'm used to, but I can give back as good as I get. But I think, by and large, I've worked with colleagues who have respected the fact that we're prepared to share together about our beliefs, even though we accept and understand that we maybe have different ideas and coming from different places.
Now, Matters of Life and Death was published in 2009, I think you said, and it sounds like you're working on some new work. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes, thanks. I'm at the moment, I'm working on a book about really about the other end of life, about death and dying. Certainly in the UK, issues about physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia are very live. And also, it's just been publicized in Belgium that euthanasia has been extended to children of all ages, and in the Netherlands, in fact, euthanasia of newborns is happening. So these are very live issues in the modern world, and I'm trying to wrestle with some of these questions and say, you know, is it possible that this kind of mercy killing is a good way forward for medicine, or is there a better way? I personally believe that actually palliative care, caring for dying babies as well as for dying adults, with respect and with love and with tenderness, but not deliberate killing, I personally believe that's a better way.
And is that controversial?
It is controversial. There are people who are arguing for the right to die. Again, it's about control. People are saying, if I can control every other aspect of my life and my fertility and my health, why on earth can I not control the time and the manner of my dying? And for modern people, that's a big issue, and it's an issue which I think as a society we're going to have to continue to wrestle with.
Well, you kind of stole my next question, which was really looking ahead 20, even 50 years, where you see medical ethics and faith intersecting or conflicting. Like, what will be the issues 50 years from now?
Gosh, well, whenever doctors have tried to predict the future, I think we've universally got it wrong.
Get so back to the humility point.
I really don't know. All I know is that technology is going to increase and is going to have to be able to do more and more, and is going to raise, as the technology advances, it's going to raise even more dilemmas and challenges for us as physicians trying to do the best. And the only way we can cope with that is by really wrestling and engaging from our different understandings of what it means to be human and what we're here for on this planet.
Great. Well, thank you, Dr. Wyatt. This discussion has been really eye-opening, and I hope it sparks and continues discussions in households throughout the globe.
And Dr. Wyatt, one other question is about what patients desire in these conversations. There's been some literature that patients, more patients than we realize, want to talk about their own faith, want their doctors to ask about those values, and want to have these conversations, even whether they think their doctor is a Christian or a Jewish person or whatever, of the same faith or not. And what has been your experience with this, with what patients want and need with respect to you sharing your faith and asking them about their faith?
Well, that totally fits with my own experience, because I think, you know, when you're facing some ultimate catastrophe, some total life disaster, such as, you know, facing the possibility that my child might be permanently brain damaged or might die, or, you know, and you're having this incredibly significant conversation with a physician looking after your child, then for most people, you don't just want some kind of professional technocrat who just talks about risk ratios and
like a robot.
You know, a robot who just, you know, regurgitates what, well, it's up to you and your choices and so on. Above all, what you want is a human being. You want somebody who would be a wise friend to walk you in this, because patients usually feel utterly at sea. I've never been in anything like this situation before. This is completely new. I'm utterly out of sea. What on earth do I do? It's like you reach out for a hand.
Tell us, Dr. Wyatt, for our listeners who are interested in your book that you've already written and want information about this future book, where can our listeners get information about that or buy your book?
The book is called Matters of Life and Death. My name is Wyatt, W-Y-A-T-T, and you can find it on the internet. It's available in a Kindle edition, and the publisher is called InterVarsity Press, and that will be the same publisher for the new book, which I hope will come out in 2015.
We are going to take a short break and come back to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Karen Helpert.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, we'll spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, we want you to send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'll have our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our house call questions today. We've got one about itching and sneezing and a new baby kitten, one about a boyfriend and his health and diabetes, another one about fibromyalgia and a parent, and another one about a lump on someone's arm. Let's take our very first house call question, Erica.
I'm a 28-year-old male who has recently noticed that I'm itchy, sneezing frequently, and I've had watery eyes ever since my roommate brought home a baby kitten. I've never been one to have allergies, but I'm wondering if it's possible to have adult-onset allergies. I find it odd that I've never had these symptoms around animals before. I would appreciate your thoughts.
This is a great question. Having new animals around the house can always be a stimulus for allergies of any sorts. Even if you haven't had a reaction to animals before, if you're around this kitten around a lot, you're touching the skin and rubbing your eyes or scratching your nose, it's very common to get allergy-type symptoms. I think the really good place to start would be to make sure that after you pet the cute little kitten that you wash your hands with soap and water, especially before you scratch your eyes or touch your nose. If that doesn't seem to do the trick, you can always try over-the-counter antihistamine agents such as Benadryl. You can even try Zyrtec or Claritin, which are both daytime allergy medications.
Well, that is good advice, Karen. And, you know, we certainly hope it's not that sweet baby kitten. It could be seasonal allergies or something else in the environment that's setting it off. But it is relatively common that for people to get adult onset allergies. And if the timing corresponds with that kitten, it really might be something about that cat's fur or something about the cat that that you're allergic to. So I would agree with Dr. Halpert's recommendations. Good luck to you, and thank you for writing us this very important question. We hope you get to keep the kitten because you sound sweet.
I've been dating my boyfriend for about 6 months now. He's been a diabetic for a few years, but he doesn't take the disease as seriously as I think he should. I want to make sure he's eating right, exercising, and making sure his blood sugar is where it's supposed to be. The problem is, he becomes a bit agitated when I bring things up. So I try to read his blood sugar levels over his shoulder when he takes them, but I don't even know what these numbers mean. At what range should his blood sugar be?
That is a fantastic question.
It's a tough dilemma that you're in.
It really is, and I really applaud you on taking interest in your boyfriend's life and trying to help him with his disease, knowing that you're really in a tough place in terms of helping motivate him to take care of his health. I'm going to just address this first bit about the glucose readings, that's the blood sugar readings on the glucometer. And ideally, we want a couple of readings during the day. The first reading is the fasting blood sugar, which you take when you wake up in the morning before you've eaten anything. And ideally, we want that blood sugar less than 140. The next readings doctors will take, sometimes we want a reading right before a meal, or what we call preprandial, pre-meal, or the other one is a postprandial blood sugar. And that's taken 1 to 2 hours after the meal. And normally we want that blood sugar to be less than 200.
And so what those goals are might depend on your boyfriend and his health and his doctor and what all else is going on in his life. So those are some general numbers. And we'll ask our very capable and sharp health sciences librarians to post some information on our blog about glucometer, checking your glucose, and what those levels should be. The bigger question is how to get him motivated in his own health, because it really, you know, a person has, I mean, he's the person, it's his body and his life, and finding ways to get him motivated is really where it's at. So I would encourage you to talk with him openly, that you feel like you're getting on his nerves, but that you care for him, and maybe tell him why you're interested so that you can frame it in your concern for him. Consider asking if you could go with him to his doctor appointments, if you're at that point in your relationship where that's okay. Consider seeing if he would see a counselor, if you could see a counselor together to talk about these very, very challenging dynamics.
And I think the other thing you can do is, you know, if you're worried about his meals, make sure that if you're cooking, that you're making healthy meals. And there are lots of good resources at the American Diabetes Association about recipes that you can use, and also exercising together as well.
Good advice. Let's take our very next house call.
My mother was diagnosed with fibromyalgia about a year and a half ago, although I think she had it for quite a while prior to being diagnosed. She really seems to be on a downward spiral these last few months, and believe that she's also suffering from depression and anxiety. I'm trying to convince her that it's time to retire so she can take better care of herself, and my dad agrees. She's 59 years old, and although she doesn't want to, I think it's the best thing for her. What do you think?
Well, that sounds like a big, complex world and family dynamics as well. You know, my first thought is, I mean, retirement is a big decision for a person. And it may be that her depression, anxiety, and treatment of that should be the focus first, so that she's feeling well enough to make a decision about what the time should be for her retirement. It may be that her job is something important to her and that really helps her sense of well-being, and that once she was feeling better from the depression, anxiety, that would be something really positive in her life. But it also could be, and it sounds like it is, a source of stress. So obviously complex. What are your thoughts, Karen?
You know, my thought, fibromyalgia, one of the major components is kind of that sadness and depression, anxiety component of it. And I agree. I think that definitely needs to be taken care of. And it's fantastic that she has the support of you and your father. But I also would just really encourage you guys to stay active, as that exercise and activity is one of the things that have really been shown to improve fibromyalgia symptoms.
And the same medicines that can help depression, anxiety, and the kinds of counseling that can help depression, anxiety also help fibromyalgia. So it's all intertwined, just as you're saying, Karen. And so taking a very comprehensive approach to exercise and sleep and medication and counseling and all kinds of steps towards wellness can make a difference. We wish you all the best and appreciate your question. Let's take our very last house call.
I have this large lump on my arm just below my elbow. It doesn't hurt, but it's not a hard mass either. I know it's not the most attractive thing one can have, and my preteen daughter is repulsed by it. I don't think I need to get it checked out because it doesn't hurt, but would like to know your thoughts.
So my initial thought would be something like a cyst or something like a lipoma, which is a fatty tumor of the elbow. Since it's not hard, I'm not as concerned for something called a tophi or something that can be associated with gout, which would be a hard lump on the elbow. Christy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could have an inflamed bursa there, but that would hurt and usually is red. Cysts and lipomas, just as you suggested, a rheumatoid nodule, but that would be hard. It sounds like it's not bothering you at all. It's more of a cosmetic thing. I would recommend that the next time you're in for your general physical, you just ask your doctor, hey, take a look at this. It's not bothering me. Is this fine? And go from there. Thank you for your question. We've had great questions today. We've had a chance to talk about allergies and a little bit about diabetes and relationships, about fibromyalgia and depression, and about a lump on the arm. Thanks for your questions and for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. Share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and get our health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine,
UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship,
and our guest today, Dr. John Wyatt, and my guest co-host today, Dr. Karen Halpert. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Karen Halpert. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. presented by UNC Family Medicine.